Welcome to Gracious Words. Gracious Words is taken from the weekly women's Bible study taught by Cheryl Broderson at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.
We behold your glory, God, in the face of Christ. It shows us who you are, revealing who you are.
God is just, and in his justice, he must deal with sin. However, we must keep in mind that God is not like us when we are wronged. He is merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth.
We will come before you, Lord, in wonder, wonder. We will fall on our knees and surrender. We surrender to you.
And now here is part one of Cheryl's message titled, The Judgment of God and Grace of God.
Okay, I'm going to ask a rhetorical question. Here it comes. Ready? Have you ever gotten angry? It's rhetorical, because if you haven't gotten angry at some time, you are not normal. I think the scariest people in the world are suppressors. You know that hold it down, hold it down, hold it down. You're like, oh, it's coming, it's coming. It's not going to look good. It's coming, it's coming. I remember I had this friend and she was like seriously perfect, intimidatingly perfect. Ever have a friend like that? Their house is never a mess. Like not one thing out of place. Like they even organize the Legos of their children. It's like, whoa. So I had a friend like that. And I remember her husband would do all these outlandish things and she'd just smile. And I'd be like, whoa, that's interesting. And her kids, they were always, went to bed at the right time. She even had what time each of them got their bath. I mean, it was just her life was so perfectly structured. And she considered me to be one of her best friends. And I liked that she liked me, but I was always afraid she was going to come over at the wrong time and catch me, you know, being me. The real me. And, you know, I'm like, does she really know me? Because she's like, we're so different. And then one day she called me and she said, Cheryl. And she was like, Cheryl? I'm like, whoa. I said, yeah. And she goes, I just went outside and stabbed a tree 26 times pretending it was my husband. Then I took all his clothes and I threw them on the driveway. And I was like, really? Welcome to my world. I said, I'm so glad you're normal. I'm so glad you're real. Finally, you've been the image of perfect. And you are not perfect, but you've been trying to be perfect and you've become your own idol. And man, the worship service is over. Hallelujah. Now we can get back to worshiping Jesus and not yourself, but you know, the suppressors scare me. As women, because we are weak, when we get angry, we tend to use the weapons of our words. Jerk. Jerk is what I said. We tend to gossip because we feel like we can't change the situation, so we'll talk about them. We use innuendo. What did you think about that? Not that I'm saying anything, but what do you think? We use meanness. We're really good at that one. We use distance, kind of this cold shunning, or anything close enough to throw. Then there are people who are just hotheads. You know, hothead people, they're just always losing their temper over something. They're so touchy. You know, they're ready to take that person down all the time. Let me talk to them. I don't know what you're doing. I'll take them on. You're like, oh. Those people scare me too. As a child, I hated Green Acres. Green Acres is the place for me. Some of you are like, I have no idea what she's saying. That's good. But Eddie Albert's character, I just didn't understand why he was always so mad at, you know, Mr. Drucker and all the people around him. And he was always upset with his wife, Lisa. And I thought she was beautiful and, you know, kind of a little too good looking for him and sophisticated. And I didn't understand why he was always losing his temper. King Solomon, whose name means peace or peaceable, had quite a lot to say about angry people. In Proverbs 21:9, better to dwell in the wilderness than with an angry woman. Proverbs 22:24, don't make friendship with an angry man. Proverbs 29:22, an angry man stirs up strife. Ecclesiastes 7:9, anger rests in the bosom of fools. So have you ever realized that your anger was displaced? Like you got angry over someone and they're like, they're listening to you and they're like, no, you misunderstood me. I didn't say that they took the candy. I said that the candy was taken to give to others. And you're like, oh, excuse that. You know, but sometimes we hear one thing and we go racing away with it. We're so angry. When we find out the situation was nothing like what we thought. All that wasted emotion over a situation that wasn't even real. And when it comes to your anger, you have to ask yourself, was your anger constructive or destructive? I don't think that my anger has ever been constructive. Did it help to remedy the situation or just add to the tumult and confusion? Was there a good outcome to your anger, or did you lose control? Did things get broken? Were mean things said? Were there actions or words that you wish you could take back? The Bible says in Psalm 4:4 and Ephesians 4:26, be angry and sin not. There is a place for anger. We're going to get angry at times, but it too often moves to the next level of sin. Now, why did I say all that about anger? Because I want you to contrast that with God's judgment. Because God's judgment is not like the anger of men. When God gives his self-description to Moses in Exodus 34, one of the things he says is slow to anger. Slow. Long suffering in anger. It takes a lot to get God to the boiling point. Very, very slow. Remember, when we're talking about Noah, we're talking about 1,600 years have gone on. When we're looking at our chapters today, Genesis 5 through 8, we're going to be looking at the judgment of God. And this is a very uncomfortable thing to talk about. It's a subject we would all like to avoid. It's hard to think of the reality of hell and the coming judgment on earth because we want God to be only loving, not realizing that you cannot be loving unless you're just. If you really love your kids, you will keep them from destructive ways. If you really love your children, you won't let them walk into the fire. You won't let them go into the street. And if they do, you will grab them back and keep them safe. God is protective in his love, and you cannot be loving without being protective. God is just, and therefore he must judge sin. You cannot have love and justice without judgment. Part of the problem when it comes to talking about the judgment of God, and I've noticed it's gotten really, really quiet in here, and I know why. Judgment. Too often, men equate the judgment of God with their own anger. They think of God's anger as arbitrary, barbaric, unreasonable, destructive, and void of mercy. But nothing could be further from the reality of God's judgment. We're told in Lamentations 3:33 that God does not afflict willingly. Isaiah tells us that judgment is God's strange work. It's not his go-to. It's not his favorite. We're also told in James that the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. There's a difference between the wrath of man and the righteousness of God. Though it's an uncomfortable subject, it cannot be avoided. You see, we expect God to let all his beautiful creation be stolen, defiled, and destroyed, while he benevolently sits back and just smiles and says, "Oh, I just love you all so much. That's okay, go ahead and ruin it. I don't care." Would you do that if somebody walked in your house after you just cleaned it and brought dirt and began to throw it around while talking about how stupid your furniture and everything was? Would you? Would you be okay with that? I remember one year, Brian and I had been married 1 year. It was our first year. And we couldn't afford a Christmas tree. You know, you remember those days? And we found a $5 one. And to say it rivaled Charlie Brown's Christmas tree would be absolutely true. And because we didn't have any money for this Christmas tree, this $5 one, or even ornaments, we made them ourselves. We did bread dough ornaments. And then I took little Hershey's Kisses, tied little bows of fabric I had, and put them on the tree. And we were so proud of our Christmas tree. And I remember this friend coming in and just saying, "Oh, your tree is so ugly. It's so stupid. Why did you even bother? And where did you get those ornaments? And oh, I like flock trees. And and she just kept on and on about the Christmas tree. Till Brian got up, because Brian is, talk about slow to anger. This is Brian. He gets up and he goes, "We're proud of this tree. We love our tree. And we made these ornaments ourselves. And why don't you just go home and just stare at your perfect tree?" You know, we don't invite people into our house, or if they come into our house and they begin to blaspheme it, talk against it, throw dirt around, you're going to get angry. So Jesus in Matthew 21 tells a parable. The same parable is repeated in Mark 12 and in Luke chapter 20, and it's the parable of the vineyard. And in that parable, he talks about how a man planted a vineyard. That's a lot of work to plant a vineyard. It takes taking the rocks out of the ground. It takes tilling the soil. It takes building structures for the grapevines and then planting each grapevine. In those days, every vineyard had two other things besides the grapes. They had a press that was made, a special press that was made for the grapes, and it also had a tower to watch for predators, because foxes would eat the grapes and others. So it had these things. And we're told that this man built a beautiful vineyard and then he leased it out. But those who leased the vineyard refused to pay rent. They refused to give the owner the rent for this vineyard, or what was due, the fruit from the vineyard, the wine from this vineyard. They said, "No, it's ours." And so the owner sent ambassadors saying, "You know, it's time to pay. You've been using this, you've been enjoying it, it's time to pay." And Jesus said, they killed some and they stoned others. And finally he said, "I will send my son. Surely they will respect my son." But in the parable, they said, "This is the heir, the owner. Let us kill him, and then we can keep the vineyard for ourselves." Then Jesus asked the question of those listening, "What do you think the owner of the vineyard will do for those wicked renters? What do you think he'll do?" And of course, they answered rightly, "He will come, he will kick them out, and then he will give it to others that appreciate." If you were a landlord and you rented even an apartment and the person there was ruining and bringing devastation and doing unspeakably illegal things, you know, building bombs, wouldn't you like them evicted? Wouldn't you like them evicted? Wouldn't you want to start over again? Though an uncomfortable subject, the subject of God's judgment cannot be avoided, because the judgment of God is very real and very serious. And I think one of the reasons that we do not share our faith with others is because we, as believers, do not talk about the judgment of God. We ignore or neglect the issue of God's judgment, and we try to push it out of our minds. But if we look at people like, oh my goodness, they will suffer judgment unless they know of the grace and mercy of God through Jesus Christ. We're going to be, as I said, looking at Genesis 5 through 8, the story of Noah, to look at two sides of God's judgment. The first side is the standard by which God judges, because God has a standard for judgment. And it's essential to talk about whenever we talk about his judgment. God uses a very strict criteria, but also God uses a standard for judgment. And he also uses a standard for saving men. And both are as strong. Noah was saved, and he saved his family. And we need to look at the standard that he kept so that he and his family were saved in, from, and through the judgment of God. When we talk about God's judgment, I am going to give you 5 points, 5 of the criteria that God uses. God's judgment is according to God's righteousness. It's just and it's warranted because God knows everything. God knows everything. So it's righteous. His judgment is never based on misinformation. God's like, oh man, I didn't know. You know, I thought that golden thing on their table, I didn't realize it was salt and pepper shakers. I thought it was a golden calf. Sorry about that. No, God never has misinformation. God knows the thoughts of men, and he knows the intentions or the plans of the heart. But God also knows the past and the future of every person. He knows whether a person will respond to his voice or rebel until death. I have a friend right now, and her father is dying, and she has shared Jesus with him. His life has been one unhappy episode after another. His life has been all about searching, searching, searching. But this man has also spent his life saying no to God, no. Now, his daughter, he raised his daughter, my friend, in a totally godless atmosphere, totally godless. They lived as hippies. And she was told, you know, you can do whatever you want. You can make all the choices that you want. And he and his wife purposely made their lives structureless. Structureless. She said there never was, you can do this or you can't do that. She said there were absolutely no standards at all in their home. None. You like a boy? You can sleep with them. You want to smoke pot, be free, because they were smoking pot. She was raised in this environment and she absolutely hated it. So that when she was 13 and heard the gospel for the first time, she wanted that. She loved it. She was attracted to it. She started going to church and the difference in her life, the joy that came over her. And since she was that age, she's in her early 50s. She has been sharing Jesus with her father and mother. They got divorced. Her mother gave her life to Jesus, but this father is still resisting, resisting, resisting. He has grandchildren who are the fruit of my friend's life, and they are amazing. All of them so anointed, so gifted. She also married a wonderful husband. They have all been sharing Jesus and the love of Jesus with this man, and he has refused. They've been begging him. And when he was diagnosed with cancer and given just a few months to live, and the appeals got stronger, he still is saying no. And then just last week, he sent her a text saying, "I found out that I'm down to days, so I plan on ending my life myself in my time." And I think God knows how hard the heart can be and whether the heart will ever respond to the appeals. God knows. God also knows the saturation point, the point when sin has so overtaken the person that there is no coming out of it. C.S. Lewis said, "God does not send people to hell. He sends beasts to hell." He said, "Every sin is against our humanity until we are no longer human. We are more beasts than human." I don't know. That's just what C.S. Lewis said. I like it. It resonates with me. God knew everything about Noah's generation. In Genesis 6:2, we realize that God knew the exploitation of women. We read that the sons of God took whatever woman, as many women as they wanted. The sin of Eve was to see and take. And that was what happened. These sons of God, whoever they were, whether they were angelic, spiritual beings, or whether they were from the lineage of Seth, they began to exploit women and take as many women as they wanted. Whatever age, women became without worth to this generation. We're told in Genesis 6:3 that God's long suffering was being exhausted. Some spiritual breach had been crossed from which there was no return, Genesis 6:4, that a lethal race had been created, and that the wickedness of man had reached the saturation point because it was very great. It was permeating the earth, Genesis 6:5. And God knew that there was no redeemable thought in mankind. But according to Genesis 6:5, every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Earth was corrupt. All men but Noah and Noah's sons had corrupted themselves, Genesis 6:11 and 12. The earth was so corrupt, so the Lord looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way. The earth was filled with such violence that existence on earth was perilous, Genesis 6:11 through 13. My dad used to quote a hymn, and he loved to quote it. And when I quote it, you might recognize it. But he used to say, "There is a time we know not when, a point we know not where, that marks the destiny of men to glory or despair. There is a line by us unseen that crosses every path, the hidden boundary between God's patience and his wrath." The second point, so the first point being God's judgment is righteous. The second point is that God's judgment is discriminatory. In other words, it sets a difference between the righteous and the wicked. When you read the book of Job, Satan is indiscriminatory. He just hurts everybody in his way or in his wake. He doesn't care righteous or unrighteous. He hurts everyone.
The subject of God's judgment is real and serious. It cannot be avoided. As believers, it may be a reason why we don't share our faith, because we're afraid or we don't understand it. Our God is a God of mercy and grace. Judgment is not his preferred option. In the story of Noah, we will see that God has a standard for judgment, but he also has a standard for saving. This is true for us today. God has a standard for saving us, and it's his son, Jesus Christ. God provided a way for us to escape the judgment of sin and be forgiven through Jesus Christ. It is available to you today. All you have to do is ask. We hope you have been blessed by today's Bible study. For more information about the Gracious Words radio program and the teaching ministry of Cheryl Broderson, please visit our website at graciouswords.com. Coming up next time on the Gracious Words program, we'll look at God's grace towards Noah and his family as we continue our series, Our Great Creator, in the book of Genesis with Cheryl Broderson. We do hope you make plans to join us. Again, for more information, please visit our website at graciouswords.com. This program is sponsored by Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.